Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's morning show begins with the conclusion of the interview I recorded earlier this year with singer and actor Bill Hayes. In part one, which aired yesterday, we heard about his childhood growing up in Harvey, Illinois, his musical studies at Northwestern University, his prominent presence on Sid Caesar's legendary television program, Your Show of Shows, and his leading role in the original Broadway cast of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Me and Juliet. Now, part two of our conversation, which will also include a little later the presence of his lovely wife, Susan Seaforth Hayes. After that, you have the number one song in the country.
Correct.
With the Ballad of Davy Crockett. And can you just say a word about how this came about?
Yes. Archie Blyer called me on December 15th, 1954, and said, "Are you still recording with MGM Records?" And I said, "Nope." He said, "Could you record a song with me, Cadence Records?" I said, "Yep." He said, "Come by the office, please. I have a song." I went by his office about 12:30 that day, and he had a lead sheet of the Ballad of Davy Crockett. "Let's sing through it." I sang through it. He said, "Do you like it?" I said, "I love it." He said, "Do you want to record it?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Tonight?" I said, "Yes." And that's what happened. He went off and wrote the orchestration and called the instrumentalist. I went off and studied the song, and we met at 10 o'clock that night, and we recorded it one take.
Here's just a snip of the Ballad of Davy Crockett, which at the time was Billboard's number one song in the country and sung by Bill Hayes.
Davy, Davy Crockett, the king of the wild frontier. Born on a mountaintop in Tennessee, a green estate in the land of the free. Raised in the woods so's he knew every tree, and kilt him a bar when he was only three. Davy, Davy Crockett, the king of the wild frontier.
I wonder, was it fun to sort of adapt what you would typically do into the, you know, kind of a new genre? I mean, trying to sound like you were somebody out of the Western frontier that way?
Well, yes, it was. But I had been doing that all along, switching to whatever this number that I was doing was had its own style. This was just another version of that. I had sung hillbilly songs. I had sung folk songs, cowboy songs, country. Well, this was sort of all in the middle of all that. And so I just went with whatever felt like was right for the song.
And ultimately, your career included a great deal of cabaret singing as well.
Yes.
I wonder if you could just say a word about how singing felt for you in those kind of settings where you're holding a mic in more intimate surroundings, not on a stage projecting to a, you know, to a large audience in a large hall, but it's a very, very different situation, particularly for the audience. How different was it for you as the singer to be singing in those situations?
It's quite different. I came to admire saloon singers and people who worked in clubs, because it is a totally different genre, different style, different. I put the keys much lower so that The projection was not first. The microphone did the projecting, and soft crooning sounds were much more fitted. I still would use, quote, money notes, but, sometimes the orchestra was large, sometimes the orchestra was small, and you have to adjust to that. I learned a lot by working in clubs. Didn't do a lot of it, but I did enough. Sang enough in vaudeville houses and in clubs to perfect a vocal microphone technique. It's quite different.
And it sure seems like one way or another you have done things right in terms of preserving the essential beauty of your voice so very well after all these years of singing. What would you attribute your longevity to, as your longevity vocally speaking? Anything in particular that you did, or is that partly the good fortune of nature, of kind of the body and voice you were blessed with? To what do you attribute the fact that your voice is still quite lovely at the age of 89?
Well, I would say that when I was at Northwestern working with John Toms, I learned a lot, and that sustained me a lot. I learned on Broadway after many weeks of singing and speaking on Broadway that if I put a little edginess, a brightness on my tone, it carried better. I didn't have to sing so loud or speak so loud. That was very helpful. I've done some plays where I'm on stage the whole time, sometimes shouting through the whole show. And if I put an edge on the sound, it carries more. And I don't have to work so hard. And that's been helpful to me. I found out early in life that smoke and drink make singing difficult. On Broadway, one night I went out to dinner between the matinee and evening show, and everybody else was having a glass of wine, so I had a glass of wine. Well, relaxed my chords enough so that the A flat at the end of No Other Love was extremely high. It was like a, tones higher. It was very difficult. So I fortunately have not been addicted to those. I don't know.
Learned a good lesson there.
Yeah, that was a big one. I can remember the night. Wow, was it high.
You mentioned earlier on that your father sang to you just about every morning when you and your brothers would wake up. I'm trying to remember, have you, among all of life's experiences, been a father yourself?
Yes, I in college, married Mary Hobbs, and we had five children. I still have four of them, and then 12 grandchildren and 21 great-grands.
And did you try to make your home sort of the same music-filled home that you grew up in Harvey, Illinois?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I love music, and music's good for the soul. And all my kids, none of them went into singing to make a living, but they all have enjoyed singing and enjoyed music a lot.
Very good.
Yep.
All right, I've paused the tape. This has been just great and so much fun. If we should finish up with just a couple words about Days of Our Lives, if you don't mind, unless maybe you have to go.
No, I don't have to go.
Okay.
And Susan is back home, and she's ready whenever you would like to have her join in.
That great. If she wants to get on the other line, we will we'll finish up by talking about this chapter of your lives. That'd be great.
Okay.
So.
Let me find her here.
Hello.
Here she is.
Hey.
This is Greg Berg.
How do you do, Greg?
I am so
talking with you.
So excited to be talking with you too. At this point in our interview, I'm delighted to say that we are joined by the beautiful wife of Bill Hayes, Susan Seaforth Hayes. And at this point, we get to talk about the really exciting collaboration, which they've enjoyed in a number of different ways, including co-authoring a couple of highly regarded books, and of course their performances over the course of many, many years on Days of Our Lives. Susan Seaforth Hayes, why don't you tell us about the day you first met Bill Hayes? I understand it was sort of bedazzlement at first sight, at least on your part.
Well, I had purchased Bill's records. I also had a copy of The Ballad of Davy Crockett and various other songs that he had recorded. I had seen him on television and been quite a fan, of course, of your show of shows. And I had seen him in the theater when he did Bye Bye Birdie. I was ushering one time at the theater there. You would get to see the show for free if you ushered, so I did, and I did. And the sight of him singing Put on a Happy Face from the second balcony was very transformative. I thought he was adorable. And I was a long way back in the theater from him, but so I knew of him as a fan and as a pop singer. Then he's suddenly on the show, and he is hired as an actor, not necessarily as a singer.
And of course, the show we're talking about is the soap opera Days of Our Lives. And you'd been on, I think, for a couple of years at that point.
At that point, it had been on maybe 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And there was plenty of soap opera on, various other shows, a lot of them in New York, all of which are gone now. But the mood on most soap operas at that time, and I had worked on others, I'd worked on General Hospital, was rather drear. There were stories of based around hospitals. There were stories about lawyers and doctors and guys in suits and ties and pain and anguish and unrequited love. More pain and anguish than mystery, violence, or romance.
Hmm.
So Bill Hayes turns up, and the writer of the show, Bill Bell, who went on to create other soap operas, including The Young and the Restless and Bold and Beautiful, immediately realized that he had something new in the cast member. All of our actors were established and good and dramatic actors, but here was a guy that could do everything and more than carry a tune. So he came on as a rogue character, as a lawbreaker who was in fact discovered in prison. Blue-collar crimes, but still, not blue-collar, white-collar crimes, but still basically a bad guy, an opportunist, a charmer. Well, that character developed into the Bill Hayes that America fell in love with, even as I had. And they began to insinuate music into the show. They were able to insinuate music into the show because Bill Hayes could write his own arrangements, sing in tune, suggest songs that were appropriate to a situation. And as soon as possible, they put him in a restaurant, and then they gave him the ownership of the restaurant so he could sing anytime he showed up.
Very handy.
Very handy, with a pianist in the background.
Ah.
Then they added Robert Clary eventually to the show and other singers to the show. Kay Stevens was on the show for a long run. Gloria Loring, Patti Weaver. Gloria's still singing. Robert Clary is still Bill's closest friend. So that element of music added so much romance. It wasn't as though you were playing a love song in the background. It was the guy that you wanted could sing the song to you. Big difference.
Absolutely. Not
other
just something playing in the background.
And
yeah. And
attempted to copy it with limited success. Immediately on CBS, characters were turning up with a guitar, having told the producer, no, I can sing. And they would discover that you had to pay for most of the music, so you wound up hearing the Battle Hymn of the Republic, sung with mixed emotion by an unqualified actor who said he could sing.
Oh, dear.
But Bill went on and really turned the show around.
We sang a lot through the 70s. There was a lot of music.
A lot of music, and it would underscore the plots. Our romance was considered very popular when Time Magazine did a review of all of the soaps that were on the air. They wanted to do a cover story on pop culture, which was, of course, soap opera. They interviewed all the shows and took pictures of all the actors, but in the end, they put Bill Hayes on the cover of Time Magazine with me.
Yeah.
Which was a big boost to all of our feelings of being recognized by the country.
Right. Well, and when you think about who's been on the cover of Time, I mean, Franklin Roosevelt, Mahatma Gandhi, and Bill and Susan Seaforth Hayes.
Yeah, and a few murderers, despots, and no counts, but
right.
We got to be on it, too.
Absolutely.
And
I have to...
he really changed the face of daytime television. And, of course, then I had to catch up, which I never did, but I could try. I began to take some voice lessons, and I was lucky enough to do a few musicals with Billy, which was terrific.
Yeah.
I got to do 42nd Street with him once. Just before we were married, I did 8 O'Annie in Oklahoma with him, playing Curly, of course. And Oliver, Mame, these were great experiences for me. Also, I had started, my first paying job was as Trouble in Madame Butterfly, and discovered that my darling loved the opera more than anything, and we have spent the rest of our 40 years of marriage and 44 years of friendship going to the opera all over the world and sharing that and having opera singers for friends. We became friends with Richard Cassily and Patricia Craig Cassily, continue to be her close friend, and she's teaching voice in San Francisco now when she left the Met. So we just...
Music's been a part of our life as well, Greg.
Huge part of our life together.
Mm.
And I used to think that all the riches in the world came through your eyes. Not necessarily the gold you could clutch, because I've never had gold to clutch. But to me, the arts were painting and cinema and the visual arts. But knowing Bill, and maybe even in the last 5 years, I've begun to understand that the riches that you receive through the joy of hearing are just as precious, if not more so, and of course, eternal.
Right. That reminds me of one of the clips from Days of Our Lives that I think is especially beautiful is the occasion of a wedding anniversary of two of the older characters. It would be the characters played by Francis Reed and
McDowell Carey and Francis Reed.
Right.
Yes.
And for, I think, maybe their 40th or 50th wedding anniversary, Bill Hayes is serenading this table full of family members with the song Always,
yes,
kind of the theme song of the family. And I think this comes at a moment when the two of you, who are both in real life and on the show, had been married. That is, your character's married.
At that moment,
you're estranged. So he's singing this.
I can't remember what the problem was, but when I look at that clip, I say, gee, I must have been having a big problem.
Right. Well, and I know the two characters were divorced at least once getting married.
Yes.
But it's a beautiful scene, not only because he takes the microphone around this table of various family members and kind of shares the mic with various castmates, two at a time. From you, we don't really hear any singing as much as we just see you as you're listening to especially him sing.
Yes.
And it's a beautiful moment that sort of underscores how powerful music is, and especially when there is a song that means so much to you.
It means so much to so many people. We... performed that song again more recently when the show opened a big new set that had been built in honor of the characters that were played. It's called the Horton Town Square. And the characters that were played by Mac and Francis, who have both passed away, were immortalized by this this imaginary town center in the imaginary town of Salem Anywhere, USA, which is where Days of Our Lives takes place.
So we sang a duet version of Always.
And we sang a duet of I'll Be Loving You Always, which was very sentimental for us and very nerve-wracking at the same time for me.
Sure. But how fun for you to have a collaborator like your husband, Bill, in this venture. Right. Not too shabby.
No.
I know the two of you have collaborated on two books as well.
Absolutely.
As a matter of fact, you have a dual memoir which I bought when it first came out and enjoyed, and of course I couldn't lay my hands on it this morning. I have about 1,000 books at home, so couldn't find it, unfortunately, but I remember reading Sands Through the Hourglass, I think
Thank
is the name
you.
Of it. Yeah.
Yes, we put that together in 5 months. Walking to opposite ends of the house and saying, how do you remember how this happened? Well, I remember it this way. Well, I remember it that way. So we wrote it in two voices, and we came in on our deadline, and our editor was astonished. We said, why is that? Said, writers never make their deadline. I said, well, we're from show business. If you don't make the deadline, you get the job. So,
fair enough.
So we enjoyed doing that a lot, and had some nice success with this. And then following that, our editor suggested that we should write a novel together because she felt that though we were happy in our work as actors and Bill as a musician, we really were a hidden talent was in writing. So we spent the next seven years researching and traveling the world, creating a story about a female performer in the age of Napoleon, and went to the Waterloo battle site and even to Egypt because we tied her story in with another famous historical character of the period called Belzoni. So we learned a lot about theater and music in England at the time of Jane Austen, which is also the same period. So we had a wonderful time doing that. And the name of that book is Trumpet. And people look at it and look it up online and see it must be a textbook for playing the trumpet. But no, it's her family name.
Ah, actually, I was going to ask you about that. I heard an interview that the two of you gave at the time that was published, in which you said that the two of you grew incredibly close. I mean, as close as you'd already been, you grew even closer through the course of writing these two books, and especially this second one. I'm just curious, what was it about writing this book together that drew you closer? I mean, what about the writing process made that happen?
Well, two brains are better than one. And, for example, Bill can write in iambic pentameter without any stress whatsoever. And he will come up with a whole scene in an imaginary play just like that. And I can't possibly do that. I'm agog. And then I'll say, but what were they wearing? But what was the response in the house? What was the air like at the time? What were the tastes? What was the sensuality of the moment? So I did a lot of color and build a lot of dialogue. And then we would evaluate each other with loving tolerance. And the final editing was the two of us sitting side by side with large format in front of the computer and saying, what do you think of it? No. We use that word three chapters back. We have to have another word for that. No, that's extraneous. No, we've already covered that. Keep it moving.
Wow.
And it was great. There's nothing like collaborating on a work of art with someone you respect. I would highly recommend it for all marriages which are under a bit of stress. Try creating something besides each other's nagging at each other's
right.
tempers.
But it's strange. We did learn a lot from each other just going through that process.
Hmm. Yes.
Terrific. I want to also give you a chance to just say a word about, let's call it, the often maligned world of soap opera. That is, then and now, it's often an assumption people make that we're talking about acting and writing and production that is a level down from, for instance, primetime television or other kinds of
correct.
Of television
so
programming.
And down generally in budget. Okay. So the story is extremely important. You're liable to see a repetition of sets. The acting is extremely important because in your movie stars, in your greatest stars, how many hours of your life did you spend with them? Even if they did 50 movies, even if you saw the movie several times, we're talking about dozens of hours or maybe, in an extreme case, maybe if you saw every Spencer Tracy film three times, 100 hours. Garbo, maybe 12 hours. Even Tom Hanks, how many hours have you spent with him? But in the soap situation, you have spent thousands and thousands of hours with these actors. And if they captured your imagination, held your attention, touched you emotionally, uplifted you, this is a great achievement. So the people who have lasted in soap are not only facile, they're pretty damn good.
Right, absolutely.
It's rare that people transition out of being soap opera stars into being movie stars. It has happened. It does happen. But generally, you have so much work going on, and the money begins to flow in a way that you didn't expect, and you're raising a family, and you say, well, I like it here in Connecticut, or, you know, this isn't so bad living in Studio City, California. Maybe I just want to go on with it instead of dumping it once.
And but I understand
that. And a lot of it has to do with what your agent tells you you should be doing. You know, a lot of careers have been destroyed by the bungling agent getting in the middle.
Mm. I understand the people who deride soap. That's what I thought it was. I thought it was lower, a set below, until I got on it. But I had never seen it, so.
Yeah, so most of the people that are saying aha soap opera or aha fiction are missing a lot. there's often a lot of good culture and pop culture, as Susan Sontag discovered. You didn't have to have read all the great books to know something. Hmm. Some people just had talent.
Right.
Yeah.
But when I got on Days, I realized very quickly how wonderful the actors were. and the writing. It's what a feat. Days of Our Lives started in 1965.
And it's still there.
And it's about, this November, it's its 50th anniversary.
Wow. Wow.
And
most
of the original audience has moved to a higher plane, but they have managed to capture new audience with new cast, and it's been a revolving door for writers and producers. So it's just always been a really good show.
Absolutely. It's one I remember my mother watching very faithfully back in the 1960s, and I would, every so often when I'd be home from school for one reason or another, would peer over her shoulder. So even from the days when the two of you were first on the program, I was probably getting a peek of you at you from time to time, and still enjoy catching up with the good folks of Salem, as I know you enjoy the occasional visits which you get to make to the program.
We still love it.
When I teach about opera, I often mention to newcomers to opera, I mean when it's a group of students who aren't music majors or whatever, and we're talking about the plots of certain operas, which are sometimes a bit far-fetched, where some character walks into the room and sees a woman in a cloak and jumps to the conclusion that it's not her or whatever. And, never in grand opera, people never bother to ask a question first. They just leap to conclusions, and, of course, all mayhem ensues. But that's one of the things that generates the
excitement and
absolutely.
The emotional highs. It goes from emotional high to emotional high.
Right. And in some respects, it's probably not a coincidence that soap opera has the word opera in it, because to some extent, some of the plots of juicy soap operas are kind of driven by some of the same elements. As opera fans, do you see a parallel there as well?
Oh, sure.
Yes. What could be a better soap than Cab and Peg?
True enough.
I mean, both of them are so charged with passion. Cavalleria rusticana.
Yeah,
loaded.
The immediate consequences.
Pagliacci, so loaded with intense passion at its height. Reedy Pagliaccio. What could be more like a soap? Wonderful.
Absolutely. So you guys, in addition to all that keeps you busy, get out to the opera on a fairly regular basis from the sounds of it.
We have been attending the Los Angeles Opera since it was the New York City Opera on tour.
Ah.
We have finally achieved fourth row center. Moving up in the world. We have had our tickets for so long, and we're very much enjoying the Met in HD. I mean, that has become the great Saturday morning treat for us to sit amongst all those old Russian ladies who also attend and go to the Metropolitan Opera.
And the Los Angeles Opera, we've been going to their seasons for almost 25 years now. They do wonderful work. They really are good.
Absolutely.
LA Opera has. We've watched it grow and do some fantastic work. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Placido is the artistic director, and I think he has a lot to say. James Conlon is their principal conductor.
Yeah, James Conlon.
He's wonderful.
When James Conlon first came to L.A. and was doing these lectures prior to the performance, they had somebody that would ask him a leading question, or it was supposed to be an interview. They were supposed to be asking him questions. Well, the first time I heard him speak, they asked one question, and he went on for 45 minutes. And by the third time, they didn't bother with a person quizzing him. Oh, they just give him the microphone and let him go. And
he's amazing. Every night that he's conducting, he does the lecture beforehand from 6:30 to 7:15.
Yeah.
He talks, and he's wonderful.
And I don't know how he has the energy to conduct. He gives so much in these lectures, and they're massively attended now. I think he has a great following in Los Angeles. It's very lucky to have him, and I hope his health continues to be good.
He has a very good following in the Chicago area, too, at the Ravinia Festival, which is the summer home of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, and presides over all kinds of exciting things there, including this summer Wagner's Flying Dutchman. So we know the name of James Conlon very well around here.
Yeah,
so
he conducted a Dutchman for us last season.
Very good. Well, this is a delight to talk with both of you, and I want to wish you only happiness and great health in the years that stretch ahead. Are you at work on another book or thinking about another book?
My husband is at work on a sequel to Trumpet.
Wow.
Yes, he is.
Well, it's hard to find time, but I do work on it.
And this is, I hope, in some way will be a yet another collaboration with the two of you.
Undoubtedly, in time it will. I'm letting him do the hard part.
Very good. Bill Hayes and Susan Seaforth Hayes, a great treat for me to speak with both of you today on the morning show. Very best wishes to both of you.
Thank you, my dear.
Thank you, Greg.
We want to remind you that a special Bill Hayes fund has been created under the auspices of NATS, the National Association of Teachers of Singing, to help fund a cash award that will be given as part of that organization's National Music Theater Competition. Anyone interested in making a contribution is invited to go to the website of NATS, which is www.nats.org. My thanks again to Bill Hayes and Susan Seaforth Hayes for joining me on The Morning Show. Now, part two of today's program. I'm very excited to be speaking for the next few minutes with Trista Sutter. And she is a well-known name and face, particularly to people who watch television's The Bachelor and specifically The Bachelorette. Trista Sutter was featured at the very, very beginning of The Bachelor series and, in a sense, left at the altar, disappointed by the bachelor named Alex, but her heartache at coming so close and yet not ending up with the bachelor turned into a tremendously great joy not long after, when she eagerly agreed to be part of the first season of a new spinoff series, The Bachelorette. And it was there that she met Ryan, and with whom she is still happily married and raising a lovely family. And life is good for Trista Sutter, but not always easy. And she remains grateful for it all and has written about that very important quality of gratitude in a new book called Happily Ever After, The Life-Changing Power of a Grateful Heart, published by Doc Capo. And we have Trista Sutter on the phone for the next few minutes to talk with her about her book, about some of these experiences, and most importantly, about the quality of gratitude, which all of us need more of in our lives. Trista Sutter, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me.
Really, really happy to talk with you. I have enjoyed your book very, very much.
I'm glad to hear that. Thank you.
I want to ask you just a couple quick questions about your experience on television. You talk about all of this in the course of the book. As I mentioned, you were on that early season of The Bachelor, came so close, fully expected you were going to be the choice of The Bachelor, Alex, and then ended up instead being passed over in favor of somebody else. It was a heartbreaking surprise for you. And you mentioned that for 3 months contractually, you had to keep that experience entirely to yourself. Could you just say a quick word about what it was like to experience something so wrenching and not be able to share about it with your closest friends, with your relatives? What did you learn from that period of enforced silence? And how difficult was that?
Oh, gosh. Incredibly difficult. I mean, I'm kind of known for keeping a secret. My parents knew, I think they had an inkling of who I ended up with, but they didn't know that we were engaged. So even my parents didn't know that I was engaged for 3 months, so I'm known for being able to keep a secret. But it was really hard. It was challenging and something that I wouldn't have chosen to do voluntarily. But, you know, it was actually a little bit of a blessing in disguise in that because Ryan and I couldn't be together, and there wasn't texting, mind you, we didn't spend a lot of time on the computer, and we talked a lot. We spent that 3 months just talking on the phone, having great conversations, and really getting to know each other because, you know, we had only been engaged after 6 weeks, so there was a lot we needed and wanted to learn about each other, and those 3 months actually allowed us to learn more because we were forced into talking on the phone
right.
for privacy reasons. So,
and I should think that enforced silence with family and friends probably also reinforced how much you would have and reinforced your appreciation for what they meant to you, both in that happy silence with Ryan and in that unhappy silence with the Bachelor series too, where in a sense you had to keep some of this hurt away from them.
Yeah, it was not easy, especially because I was really hurting and didn't have anyone to talk about it with. So it was really difficult and something I wouldn't recommend for anyone else to do, going through heartache alone.
Hmm.
But, you know, it made me stronger, and it got me to where I am now. So I don't regret having to go through it.
And as you say that, it reminds me of something you say in the book about keeping the hard things of life in perspective, and that we learn from even the most difficult experiences, maybe especially from the most difficult experiences.
For sure.
And you write, no experience, no matter how bad, is a waste unless you waste the lesson. I think you say that very well, and I'm sure as you look back on your life, there are probably moments you've wasted certain lessons and other moments where you've taken a lesson to heart and your life is so much better for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if anyone watched the vow renewal special that was on ABC this weekend, I think it's actually re-airing this Saturday as well, if people have not seen it. But we renewed our vows after 10 years, and there was a special on ABC, and they show us talking about how, you know, when I kind of said my vows in the vow renewal, I just did it off the cuff. And one thing I said was, you know, thank you for everything. I love you, and I love our relationship. I'm so grateful for it, even the hard times, because It got us to where we are. It made us stronger. It made us realize the gift that we do have in each other. I think that those difficult times in life are when we need to look to the positive even more so and try to look for the lesson.
Mm. You are known for the place that gratitude has in your life, and this became known to a fairly wide circle of people because of a practice which you undertook at one point. I believe you would primarily do it maybe through Facebook, or I'm not sure if it was with a blog or something, but choosing to remember and share with the world your favorite moment from that day that was just over. Tell us when you started that and exactly why, or if anything in particular prompted you to undertake that practice.
Yeah. So I've been doing what I call my favorite part of the day. It's hashtag fave part of day. I've been sharing it every day for the past 4.5 years since my daughter was born. And she will, well, actually more than 4.5 years. She'll be 5 in April. And I decided to do it because I was looking at my life and just thinking of how grateful I was. But I wanted, it was hard. It was difficult when you have a newborn. You aren't getting any sleep. And, you know, it's not necessarily pain-free. So I wanted to do something to actively remind myself of all the blessings I had. And so I started doing this fave part of day when she was born. And it's really a way to hold myself accountable and look for the positive and reflect on the good things that happened, especially if, you know, it was a particularly bad day. And I've heard so much from people who are reading the book and are, you know, who do follow me on Twitter and Facebook, that they are doing the same thing, and it's changing their life. It's changing their perspective, and I'm so thankful for that I'm able to reach all of these people that without social media, I would never be able to reach. So it's quite a journey this book is taking me on.
Mm-hmm. One of the best things you say, I think, in the whole book is that expressing your gratitude isn't an extra, it's everything. In other words, we shouldn't think of it as sort of the frosting on the cake or the cherry on the sundae or this extra little thing you do, but in fact, it needs to be a bedrock part of your everyday life and the way that you look at everything.
So important. I think in all aspects of your life, I have a chapter called The Business of Being Happy. It's all about gratitude in the workplace. And each chapter is broken down into different relationships of your life, like the relationship with your partner, your kids, your friends, family, coworkers, strangers. And in The Business of Being Happy, it talks about how most people leave their jobs or, decide to leave their jobs because their boss doesn't appreciate them or they don't feel appreciated. And so I think and obviously it needs to play a role in the relationship you have with their partner, because if you don't feel appreciated and you're not giving appreciation, you're not going to be happy. And the same thing with your kids. They need to grow up with role models who are actively appreciating things so that they'll do the same. And because, you know, when you appreciate things, it just comes back to you. It's a full circle.
Right. And as you say in a whole chapter devoted to raising your children, we don't become grateful by accident. We really need to be raised to be grateful. We need to be encouraged to be grateful.
Oh, yeah. I truly believe in that. I mean, nature, nurture, you know, they're born to be open to things, but we need to be able to teach them and show them how to live a happy life and what they should be looking for in their life. And I think one of those things is gratitude and looking for someone who is going to show them that kind of love and appreciation in their life.
Your book is full of tangible, practical sorts of tips on living a more grateful life, and I like how you share many tips and suggestions from some of your friends, things that they do to maybe jumpstart their gratitude or throw focus on it. And you share the thoughts of other writers, including somebody you quote who has this notion of the DYK, did you know? It's a device by which we reconnect with maybe older relatives and find out more about them. How do you fold that practice into this whole matter of gratitude?
Well, I think that the more that you, this study, what you're referring to, it's a study in the scientific community about how they found that the more, basically, it's called the Do You Know Scale, D-Y-K, and the more that you know about your family, the more that you are conversational with your family, the more you feel connected to them, the more that you're going to be able to live a happier life. So if you're able to be informed about your family, if you sit down at dinner or you sit down at family gatherings and you have discussions about what has happened in the other people in your family's lives and you know what happened through the history of, you know, your family, you're going to feel more connected and feel more appreciative for that history and the things that everyone went through to get you to where you are today. So I think it's really important. It's so important to, you know, gratitude is infused in everything. Mm. And I think it's just a way of living, you know,
course.
And I hope that people give it a chance and don't just think that, you know, this book is all about me, because it definitely is not.
In the last 20 seconds, what have you learned about gratitude, most importantly, from your husband, Ryan? What has he taught you about gratitude?
I think that, gosh.
Maybe too many things to list.
I know, right? Yeah. He's such a good person. He's such a kind person, and he's always trying to do better for people that he comes in contact with, including his family. So I think it's just, and it goes with gratitude. I think it's just a way of thinking positively and acting positively toward the people in your life.
Mm. Nicely put. So much is good food for thought in your book, Happily Ever After, The Life-Changing Power of a Grateful Heart, published by Doc Capo. Trista Sutter, thank you for writing this lovely book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk
Thanks
about it.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, pays his monthly visit to the program. Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Let's look at our weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois. It calls for partly sunny skies today and a high temperature of 70 degrees. Partly cloudy overnight, low of 49. Mostly sunny tomorrow and actually warming up to 73 tomorrow for a high. Thursday, partly sunny, a high of 68 degrees. The story changes a bit on Friday with cloudy skies and a 40% chance for rain with a high of just 55 degrees. And chilly over the weekend, but it should become once again sunny. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR